Whatever, man. Decentralization, like fucking yeah. I guess they've got to like they've got to analyze something, right? And there's a market for analyzing that limited range of some things. But most of the things that are being analyzed aren't exactly like I don't know. They're not fucking big decentralized. They're not big. They're not really big on moving the needle on decentralization. They're certainly not big differentiators for one validator versus another half the time, as far as I can tell. Anyway, it seems like a load of bullshit to me.
Welcome to Game of Nodes, a weekly podcast from independent validator teams.
Hello, and welcome to Game of Nodes, a weekly podcast from independent validator teams. When is Thanksgiving? We're down two members due to the turkey fucking holiday. I assume you don't fuck the turkey, do you? You cook the turkey.
Well, it must be soon.
It's this week, I assume, right? This Sunday? Is it always on a Sunday or is it in the middle of the week?
I honestly couldn't give you. I couldn't tell you. I'm looking it up. It's unconfirmed still. Why not just give me a date? No, straight into the history. Okay.
Little D in the chat says it is tomorrow.
First Sunday in October.
Yeah, I can say we're not in October, man.
Thursday in November. It's
on Thursday. Fourth Thursday in November. That is indeed, as the chat's pointed out, that is tomorrow. Happy days.
Yeah, so Serp has taken the family on a holiday. So he's off having a good time. And Schiltz is preparing the turkey, stuffing it. Yeah.
Legit. Yeah.
I mean, there must be a lot involved with this food preparation if it's like, you know, shirking the responsibilities to
I think it's like Christmas. It's like Christmas, isn't it?
I've never done like a Christmas thing where you spend like, I don't know, a day preparing all this stuff.
Yeah. I mean, I have, obviously, but like...
I think I would be more like... See, we've only recently like gotten a house. So, you know, that's a requisite to do a Christmas, to like bring people into it.
And well, you just do family, right?
Yeah, exactly. But you need a house for it, right?
Yeah, but somebody in your family draws a short straw and everybody goes to their place and is like... Feed me. I brought some part of the meal. Now you must feed me the rest of the meal.
So I'm really banking on this fucking driveway situation that I've got that's going to keep people away. Nice house, but just really banking on this driveway, just keeping away the people. They'll be like, oh, you want to do Christmas today? Then I want it to be nice and known that the driveway is incredibly shit and there's no parking out there. So when people are like, you know, doing the straw drawing for where Christmas is going to be, we can go, oh, well, we would love to have everyone over to our place. And they go, well, it's that fucking driveway. Okay. Yeah, it is a bit shit, isn't it?
I think your driveway is bigger than my entire street, having seen a picture of it. But, you know, that's just Australia for you.
Yeah, but it's also a cliff. It's just vertical.
Yeah, but, you know, another reaction to that would be like, toughen up.
Yeah, I mean, I don't care. I love it. I got 3.5 tons of car that I drive out with it every day, go through fucking $4 of fuel getting out of the driveway. We were looking for a you know, like a second vehicle that's smaller to get around with the kid in town. I don't know how foreign of a concept that is to like a Brit, but judging by the huff, I imagine that's like uncommon. Everyone in Australia has got two cars.
Some people have two cars if they have two jobs that are in like very different places, but like that's, I don't know, like it's not wildly uncommon, but I would say most people, like whoever really needs the car in the family would take the car, and whoever can get to where they're going on public transport de facto draws the short straw. Like I can. Yeah, even people I know that do shift work, the only people I can think of that have two cars, they're both doctors, they both work at different hospitals, and they both do shift work. So there's sometimes times when one is on a night shift at one hospital and one is on a night shift at another hospital. And if your shift is like in the middle of the night, like it's basically taxi or nothing, basically nothing. Even night buses in the city, I think, stop at 3 a.m., something like that. So, you know, you're shit out of luck, right? Anyway, but relatively uncommon is my feeling to conclude. Okay.
Well, here, basically everyone and their kid has a car. Like, the country's so fucking big, you just need a car to get around. Like, even getting into town is 15 minutes in a car. So it'll take you like half the day in public transport. Interesting.
How many miles is it to town?
Miles?
Yeah. Or kilometers, like, if whichever one you use, I don't know.
I don't know. 20?
10? 20 miles.
10 Ks? 10 kilometers?
Oh, 20 kilometers.
No, like maybe 10 kilometers.
Okay.
It's not that far.
No, yeah, so that's about 15 minutes on a bike.
Yeah, it's about 15 minutes a car because the traffic's a bit shit.
Yeah, I've noticed that about any built-up area is the bikes the same time, if not quicker, but
So anyway, my story was...
Your story
to
was...
Do with, driveways to do with park. The house, because we're trying to look for a second car, I kept asking everyone for like all-wheel drive cars because when it gets wet in my driveway, I've heard that people have had difficulty getting out of it before we got here. So just like, you know, the wheel spinning. So yeah, but apparently like all-wheel drive cars are not as prevalent as what I thought they were. I thought they were just ubiquitous now.
No, probably not. I would guess that they're still mostly not. But hey, what do I know? Don't even own one. So
nice pause.
Yeah,
I just couldn't look like you just fucking checked out.
I just couldn't stop thinking about your driveway, honestly. I just had this moment where I was just like, imagine having a driveway so big that the gradient of the driveway is an issue. I was just like, the idea is pretty, like, it genuine. I'm being serious when I think it probably is about the size of my street, like, to even have that, because it must, like, to even have that kind of problem. Anyway, shit. Like, so yeah, So this week we're down two people. It's Turkey Week. Whatever the American technical term for it is, Thanksgiving time. We don't really know what's involved with that, presumably turkeys and stuff. Happy days. Shout out to all of the American listeners of the podcast. What else has been happening? Tornado Cash is what's been happening, right?
Well, can you...
Or am I jumping into news too quickly? Because I think this is an interesting...
No, well, do tell. What is the drama with Tornado Cash?
So, right, with the caveat here, right, that my very fucking limited understanding of American judicial processes suggests that this is kind of a nothing, like it's the first in a long step of things that mean something before it actually means anything. But an American appeals court has ruled that the SEC, I want to say it's the SEC, but I actually don't fucking know, because I'm professional on that. Was basically overreaching with the whole Tornado Cash thing. And it's basically the whole thing is super interesting. But one of the most interesting things that the court ruled, again, my understanding of American law is that this is like a minor court and all this shit needs to escalate to somewhere where it fucking matters. So, you know, whatever, but it is a judicial, yeah, it is potentially a judicial precedent, is one of those things that will then be discussed and yada, yada, yada. So I think it's interesting, right? One of the interesting things that came out was the fact that the smart contract was deployed, I believe, as I, you know, I'm not completely aware of the exact intricacies of how Tornado Cash worked, but my understanding is it's deployed as a immutable smart contract. And the argument was that nobody has any control over it in that situation, because once it's deployed, it's deployed. And that's like really interesting from a liability perspective, right? Because like a lot of the arguments about this were not about, you know, the freedom of the users or privacy or using mixers or anything like that. A lot of it's like quite mechanical of like, well, nobody has liability for this, was my understanding of it. So it's pretty interesting. And obviously anything that can be used to make techniques for obfuscation of identity more viable is a really interesting like it's a really interesting space for like judicial rulings and regulation and legislation and stuff, because like it's such a fine and difficult line that I think has a lot of different feeling on each side, right? It's so core to the kind of the feeling around the technology. So yeah, we'll post a link in the show notes. Maybe somebody with somewhere with a bit more analysis, right?
So I mean, just skimming over the article, it is interesting because I mean, this decision. So one of the main reasons that they went after Tornado Cash was to go after the technology, right? But sort of now with this decision, it's come up that. So I'll read this section. It says, the decision answers a controversial privacy debate on whether the government, via sanctions list maintained by the US Treasury Department, has the right to target technology because it's associated with criminals. So they're saying, you know, just because it's associated with criminals, does that... And it was same thing they used to say about Bitcoin, right? It's like, oh, criminals can use this to move cash around. I mean, that yes, if everyone agrees that it's worth money, then you can use it to move cash around, right? I mean, it's not really anonymous, but they're saying that criminals use this. And then they're saying, well, now criminals use Tornado Cash. But if you start making that distinction that it can be used by criminals, then basically everything's a fucking target. Criminal could use a rock to throw at a person. Like,
well, criminals do use property in the city, property not in the City of London, but they probably use property in the City of London as well, actually, to be fair. But it's a common problem that people buy expensive property in London as a way of obfuscating funds. So I would imagine many other major cities and whatnot, anywhere it's valuable.
It'd be interesting to see if some... So I know that like a lot of projects sort of got put on the back burner when all this Tornado Cash thing went down. I want to say a couple of years ago now. So I wonder if this overturning will revive some of those projects. Hey?
The first ruling was 2022, like late in the year. I think it was late in the year. I think it was literally like almost 2 years to the day, right? I mean, not to the day, maybe 2 years a month, 2 years, 2 months, something like that, like autumn.
The good news is that the Tornado Cash's Torn token rallied 500%. Happy days.
Happy days. are we back, baby?
We're back, baby.
To be fair, it's one of the many indicators. It's one of the many bullish indicators, not financial advice. But yeah.
So someone went to jail because of this, right? I wonder if they're going
It was in the Netherlands, though.
Oh, okay. It's nothing to do with the US.
I don't think it's to do with the US. I mean, like, this is the thing. Like, it's interesting it's happened in the US, but the US ain't the only player in town that wants, you know, this stuff wound up.
Well, I mean, maybe this will set a precedent for, you know, action elsewhere as well. Let's hope that they get our man out of jail.
Yeah, well, there's on the privacy thing, there's a whole bunch of things that I think are kind of understood in the privacy literature, like academic literature on the subject, that are, look, lawmakers have to like rule in a certain way, they have to legislate, and obviously, like, subtlety is not necessarily a valuable quality, and normative opinions and stuff like that are also not a desirable quality in lawmaking. But I think like the property that there's a different context and a different argument and a different set of laws or decisions that should be made for some random degen who wants to send $5 of Bitcoin or Ethereum or whatever the fuck it is, and wants to use Tornado Cash as a mixer. The context of that person's privacy is very, very, very different from somebody trying to move $200 million or something like that, or, you know, repeatedly moving that. And it's not like... When you move a lot of cash, right, so eventually somebody has to accept it to be spent, right? And that's how these things always get found, right? Even when people, before on-chain analytics got as sophisticated as it is now, you know, there are still people getting busted all the time for Bitcoin, for large Bitcoin holdings, because eventually you try and do something in the real world with it and somebody has to say, hey, where did this money come from? And there isn't a good fucking answer. So like it's a tricky one. It's a tricky one because I think the money laundering and the money laundering and what it's called, CFT, the counterterrorism financing or whatever, and all that sort of stuff. Like, I can absolutely see the rationale for it, but I think it's such a heavy-handed instrument for affecting the average end user who is not doing anything like that. Like, it's really fucking tough. I do get it's like a really tough thing to legislate, even as I don't necessarily agree with the way that stuff is going necessarily. But hey, this is probably a good thing for privacy, right? This ruling. So, you know, hopefully it sets some kind of a precedent or at least reopens the discussion in a more sensible way. Maybe, don't know, possibly.
Possibly.
Is this, I don't know, fuck it. Is this bullish? Like the main question we need to ask ourselves now, let's not worry about any of the nerd privacy bullshit. That's whatever, man. Let's keep it to the level of cutting insight and analysis that viewers and listeners come to expect to Game of Nodes. Is this a bullish indicator? Yes or no?
Well, I think anything that is positive towards crypto is like part of the conglomerate of news that will make crypto bullish again. So I think the general consensus is bull market now for, you know, the next period. You know, how long's a period? 6 months, 2 years, who knows?
One day.
No financial advice. But I think there's like a few things stacking up now. You know, now that you've got what is potentially a crypto-friendly government in the United States. And then, you know, Elon Musk having like a pretty big influence, I guess you would say, on the government at the moment in the United States. I think these are all things that are sort of probably going to start to be the catalyst for pushing a bull market in crypto. You're getting good news come through every so often.
I guess it's all just mad. Like the level to which this stuff is just mad animal spirits, like genuinely deranged.
I wonder when, I think off. Like, you know, the axing of Gary Gensler will be probably the real fucking
the signal.
You know, when he gets put to pasture, maybe that'll be the real catalyst for a bull market. Who knows?
Yeah, I mean, it'll be interesting to. I mean, as you know, I don't really give too much of a shit about any of that. Like, people get really, really, really butthurt about people talking. What's it called? Not even talking smack about crypto, but just try. You know, anybody who says anything that's in any way not like to the moon. To the Moon-o, but then look at Juno. It is to the Moon. Well, it was to the Moon-o. It's now in the dustbin again. I don't know. I kind of think it's difficult. Like on the one hand, like obviously, as validators, as people who work in the space, people who want to build projects, like the return of positive sentiment is like a requirement when the markets are essentially built on the most insanely volatile asset. But then I guess a lot of the stuff that I'm kind of working on now is like, at least conceptually, like sort of doesn't really rely on its own tokens or whatever. So I guess I'm like beginning to be more flippant about what the wider market is doing, but adoption is always going to be a thing, I suppose.
Yeah, well, that's...
It's payments it's like kind of a different world, like payments versus... like cryptocurrencies are something very, very different from a payment medium. They are.
I can't imagine any implementation at the moment of crypto and cryptocurrency being like the basis of any adopted by everyone, like payments or back end for like a, you know, a ubiquitous payment system. Whatever that thing ends up being will be like owned by the banks.
It's going to have to be stables. Because...
But it won't be something that's built publicly, that's for sure. It'll be something that's built by the banks or the governments. We all want it to be like something that's built publicly and open source, but I can't imagine it will be.
I think it may well be open source. Yeah, actually. So that's a place where I disagree. I think it will be open source, but I think it will not be deployed, probably. Probably by anybody other than seriously regulated financial institutions. Like, I was having a conversation in the week with somebody about some of the use cases and things that we're working on with Future Money and stuff. And I'd been having this like, well, hang on a minute. Hang on a fucking second. Like, why do you need to wait for a central bank to move on the technology choices when you have stablecoins? As much as I fucking hate stablecoins, like, just find a back end that has native USDC and use them as your on-ramp, right? Because you're always minting one-to-one anyway. Like, it doesn't really matter as long as you're creative. Because most digital cash implementations, like, you have a ledger as a pure settlement layer just for proof. Like, it doesn't actually matter. And it doesn't, if you or somebody else or validators or whoever, like, somebody is going to have to be paid a fee for transmission, and somebody is going to have to pay the gas fees of the underlying ledger, right? If you run that ledger, you can just turn gas fees off because it doesn't matter. You can run it as a consortium ledger, right? No big deal. If you run it on a public permissionless ledger, there's still no data leakage, but you could just like write it to any third-party ledger, Polygon, a Cosmos ledger, Near, Aptos, Solana, it doesn't really matter. Somebody has to pay the gas fees, but that presumably comes out of validators or node infrastructure providers who are getting fees for the transactions, right? And I was just like, how has nobody gone to market with this exact solution with a privacy preserving technology which onboards at each end via stable coins? Because then your regulatory burden is always going to be on the recipient of the funds, right? Taking them out and then going to a centralized exchange, right? Which is exactly the situation we have right now. The obvious answer, right, being that everybody gets super sus if the majority of your business comes through stablecoins, right? So even if you're like a coffee shop and you accept stablecoins, you've got to cash them out via Kraken or Binance or something, and your business bank is going to fucking have kittens. Let me tell you, like, validators, we have this problem all the time, right? Maybe less so for you, but certainly American colleagues of ours, friends of the podcast, have had a lot of fun with being debanked. It's a thing that we've struggled with on a couple of occasions. And I guess that problem would become more widespread, and it would become an adoption problem pretty quickly, I think, if you were trying to on-ramp and off-ramp via stables. But I was trying to work out, like, why has nobody done this? And anyway, so I was talking to somebody who understands the legislation, the regulatory position at the moment, a lot better than I do. And they were like, well, it's our belief, right, that as the deployers and maintainers of the infrastructure there, even if that's just a smart contract on and off ramp, and then you run your own system over here, even if you can say about your own system, we don't know, we don't care, you become the regulator. You're going to basically become the regulated entity that has to do the CML, AML, CFT stuff, the anti-money laundering, the KYC and all that kind of stuff. And that was really interesting, because I thought, even in the case of like, it kind of makes sense in a sense, because if you ever use Circle versus just buying USDC and stuff in the wild, super easy to use, try and use Circle's platform, it's a fucking nightmare. It's really hard to use. Last time I tried to use it anyway, it was much more hassle than just using a traditional bank. And so that must be the answer, is like the regulatory burden of that stablecoin situation from a KYC perspective is still quite high. So yeah, I don't know. But this is why the Tornado Cash thing is like really interesting, because it's literally something that's come up in the last week where, you know, looking at potential on and off ramps that used a blockchain in the background, it was like, maybe this is a solution. And then people more knowledgeable than me saying, no, it's really not. Like, that's a go straight to jail deployment.
You'd think like the ideal on off ramp like issuers would just be governments, right?
Yeah, well, probably central bank, right?
Yeah, so, yeah, exactly, like a central bank or, yeah, I mean, that makes the most sense, but fuck, it's going to be a long time before.
Yeah, I mean, they're going to be, like, the extent to which a bank of last resort is ever going to be like, yeah, we're going to take on systemic risk from a blockchain ecosystem as well as our national economy. I don't know. I I tend to think you're actually never going to see that, actually. Like in some economies, sure, but I don't think you're going to see like the European Central Bank do it. I don't think you're going to see the Bank of England do it. Just from, I could be wrong, but like I went to a conference on systemic risk where there were central bankers presenting a little while ago, and I can talk about what was said, but I can't say who said it because it was Chatham House rules. But I would say that the mood of the room, the mood of the room was that like, because obviously it wasn't about blockchains, it was just about systemic risk. Although blockchains and stablecoins and things did get lightly mentioned at a couple of points. I would say that the 2008 financial crisis still is very at the front of minds of banks of last resort, was my impression, and especially in the UK anyway. Like that was where the discussion from academics and people from industry, the relative risk position of American bankers versus maybe European ones was quite different. But yeah, they're still like the risk positions they're taking are still like very, 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 they're very, very risk averse, right? And stable coins, I just don't see it like as a psychological problem. It's not as much as anything else, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean,
if they control the infrastructure, they get out into the wild, right? That's what happens as soon as these things are in any way interoperable, which they'll probably have to be in order to work. Unless of course you're talking about like they have all the infrastructure and it's a walled garden and they never, these things never get outside the walled garden, in which case maybe.
Well, I think there's just a couple of different like things that we're talking about in terms of like a payments and settlement situation that's ubiquitous. You know, say businesses are using it and the government's using it, and you know, you can transfer, I don't know, $100 to your mum and know that that's going to always be $100 every day of the week, right? I think a system like that would be a walled garden. At the same time, I think there will also be like heavily used public networks as well, but that aren't trusted by like, you know, the powers that be. Does that make sense? So it's like the,
yeah.
It's like,
so you know how you kind of talk about open, are you talking about like open banking, which is,
so, you know, in like a,
so like
in regular society, you have like your controlled, banking, right? Which is, you know, you do your cash, your transfers on the internet and all this type of stuff on, you know, through the banks. So, you know, you send your mom's bank account $100, you know that she's got that $100 every day of the week, right? And then you got people walking around with cash swapping for stuff. It's the same thing. It's just in a different system, right? It's not in that banking system now. It's out in the wild. It's peer-to-peer. People are going and giving it to each other. I think, yeah. Like, I think you will have the same assets in a different system where people use it for what they want to use it for, and then there'll be like the regulated business system that is the back end of all of the business and banking, and ubiquitous throughout the world. Though I think it'll be like, you know, that will bring together the world of banking rather than the siloed systems that are, you know, in each country or whatever.
I think that's a
the utopia.
Yes, the utopia.
To be controlled.
Yeah, just the idea that anybody can cooperate on that level, I think, is just probably not the case. But I guess like the thing where you just like send your mom $100, whatever, I guess that's kind of like the goal of open banking, right? Which is that instead of doing a card transaction, which is private money, you will just send account to account, but have the payment rails for that to even work. Because right now it is like, it's like very sus, isn't it? That you have cash or you have a card, probably. And those are probably your two options, right? And if you do a bank transfer, you can do obviously like maybe more money than you could in just cash. But it's like there's kind of no consumer protections, number one. And number two, it's like really it's more difficult. There's much more friction to provide that data. You know, like account number, sort of number or IBAN or whatever it might be, IBAN and BIC. So I think that's kind of like that's my understanding of the goal of open banking, right? Is to make that thing work for consumer point of sale payments.
Yeah. I mean, a big hurdle that they have to get over with crypto in general still is the, you know, account security and recovery of like accounts when people lose the means to access it. So, I mean, all that kind of means that there has to be a trusted third party of some description to help recover with accounts. So,
yeah, I guess that's kind of like the difference between, well, it's like it's back to accounts versus cash, right? If you drop $5 in the street, it's gone. And if you,
lose your internet banking password, you call up the bank.
Yeah, you call up the bank and you go, sort this out for me. And they go, oh, why did you drop that? And you go, oh, well, because I'm an idiot. Anyway, sort it out for me. And they do.
So yeah.
It's different things, isn't it? But yeah, either way, I don't know. Whatever. It's interesting, I think. And I think Tornado Cash thing is like continues to be interesting because inherently any solution that looks more like cash has a different privacy story and is going to cause more concern for a regulator, but I kind of think it has to exist in some form in the systems that we're building.
It is definitely the first port of call for any exploit. You always, when you read the description, like the first thing after money's stolen, money's goes to Tornado Cash. It's like,
yeah, true.
Always the first port of call. It's not like, the hacker stole $40 million and sent it directly to his personal account at Binance.
Well, yes, that is true. I mean, so something.
Are there any other platforms out there that help criminals do business quite as effectively?
Well, Royal Bank of Scotland was laundering drug cartel money, wasn't it? It was either HSBC or RBS was doing that.
I think, I remember HSBC being in some hot water for laundering of the money.
And it wasn't like a small amount of money. It was a lot of money. So
knowing nothing about that case, I imagine that, you know, some relative was being held over a hot spike for years.
Yeah, I don't know. I think they just did it.
Just went, it's good commission.
Well, yeah, like honestly, I don't think it was like super, I mean, like citation needed.
Papa needs a new Lambo.
I think it was more that than it was, we got your family. Because like you can't be like careful and what's it called? You can't be like anon sus, you know, if you've revealed your identity by like grabbing somebody's family, that's like quite public and sus, right? Whereas just like, although I suppose it happens all the time, doesn't it, with organized crime and they get away with it. So, yeah.
What is a non-sus?
Well, anon. You want to be anon, but without being sus, right? So you're just being... I was being too lazy to say all the words. So you're trying to be... You are sus, right? Because you're an organized criminal or whatever, but you want to be anon. So you are sus, but you're also anon. And if you go like kidnap,
trying to masquerade as a non-sus anon.
Well, maybe you want to be non-sus anon, I guess, right? And then if you kidnap somebody's family, then well, first of all, that person knows that pressure is being exerted on them because you've stolen their family. So you're as soon as you take their family, you enter into a game with them, where you're in a kind of zero sum situation with another party, right? Whereas if you just stay sus and anon, but maybe not sus as that situation, you're still just like some client of a bank trying to move some money without the situation having like escalated or whatever, you know?
As Ben Davis says, organized criminals have all their paperwork in order. Good point.
Yes. I can only conclude that they must do. Although, yeah, well, yeah, whatever. It's very like, as again, a couple of our banking providers have tried to, with varying degrees of success, debank us over the years. And you do go, everything we've filed is like, you literally have all that information. Like, there's not much room for hiding. If we were hiding, then we would be sus, but I don't think we're really that sus. But oh well, whatever, man. Like,
whatever, man.
As validators, we probably do the most boring job in crypto.
I don't know if that's the case. I think we've got the most glorious job in crypto.
Do you think?
Yeah.
What makes you think that?
It's just like you're in the trenches.
You're in the trenches. you're
making it all work.
You're making money. You're losing money.
You're losing money.
You're losing money. You're buying hard drives.
I love being a validator. I reckon it's great. I love the people. I like waking up in the middle of the night and doing some shit on my keyboard real quick.
Not getting angry
about it.
I fucking hate the work, but I love the people. That would be my review of validation.
I mean, I love some of the people. There's still dickheads that you don't like.
Well, no, but the people we hang out with, the teams we like and hang out with, they're all great people.
It's like anything, really, though. Sometimes you just...
Real validation is just the friends you made along the way, right?
True. But it is a job and it is a business, and sometimes you fucking hate it. But I think for the most part, I wouldn't do anything else at the moment. I most of the people, I actually like the work. I like to learn things, it's a constant learning opportunity.
I think now we're largely back on bare metal. It's literally, for me, like... what I was working on in 2014, which was like high volume data processing on bare metal. I'm like, am I like a young man again? And then creak. I'm like, nope, I'm not a young man again. I'm just living in a time vortex where
you're fucking young as, man. You can still cycle. I think about doing exercise, I fucking start to throw up.
I blew out my back tire today. Like, had to walk home like a fucking scrub.
I thought that was like a euphemism for you shit yourself.
No. Like, you know, when you know you need to do some maintenance, right? And
you just put it off.
Well, no, it wasn't even that. Like, I needed new tires, right? And for some reason, there just weren't any in stock at the bike shops near me. Like, you know, there's really like, they've got like Kevlar in them, right? To stop bottles, like broken glass and shit.
Yeah.
Like, and then in the end, I had to order them like online, and then they took a while to come or whatever, and they came in the week. But like, it takes, I don't know if you've ever tried to get those fuckers on a bike, they're really hard to get on, the ones that are reinforced. It takes fucking ages, and you cut up your hands, it's fucked. Whatever. But I knew I had to do it.
Not like, you know, flexible?
Yeah, they're not flexible at all because they've got the Kevlar and shit in them. You need to like fully fucking lever them on with like quite a lot of force, and it's always a fucking shit show, right? But anyway, whatever. I've ridden enough miles on a bike to have looked at my tires 2 weeks ago and gone, something bad's gonna happen. I can see that they're beginning to get past their best. So fucking ordered the tires. I don't even know how much it would be in Kanga bucks, probably about $150 worth of tires. I don't know. They're not cheap.
So you've like, you know, relatively cheap. You've worn through the belts. You know they're going to pop at some point. Let's go for a ride down the highway.
Yeah, exactly. So anyway, yeah. I finally got all the parts through like the other day, the tires and new inners and all that kind of shit. And I was like, right, I'm going to do this, but I don't have the fucking time because, you know, I get home from work, make food for little one, go pick up little one, feed little one.
Yeah, because life is a good excuse to not do things you don't want to do.
Yeah, exactly. And then by the time you've done all that shit, you don't want to fuck around with a bike in the cold for 2 hours.
Because you could potentially paint a figurine or drink a beer.
Drink a beer, yeah. Or you know, remaster and Commander. The usual shit that like, yeah. Whatever. It was snowing the other day here. So like it is cold at the moment. Anyway, and fucking today, like I knew it, right? So basically I got the parts the other day and I was like, right, Saturday, I've got all morning. We'll just get this done. We're going to switch all those. We're going to switch the brake pads. We're going to fucking strip the bike, re-grease everything. We're in the middle of the winter, right? It's time to do like the proper maintenance run, you know, as you do. Preventative maintenance. We're validators, right? We know that you don't put shit off until the hard drive blows up because then it wakes you up in the middle of the night and nobody wants that, right? So anyway, I had my plan. It was like Saturday, the bike will be okay till Saturday. Of course, like somebody stepped out in front of me when I was cycling home and I had to like, I was like, basically either hit this.
You had to rip a skid.
Yeah. I was like either cycle into this woman or kind of do a little skid. And then I did a little skid straight into a pothole. Tire slightly past their best. Boom.
I think in this scenario, the woman didn't exist and you were just going back to your glory days and ripping a little skid. A little skid stop at the traffic lights.
No. I've got, if I was doing that, I would be on the bike behind me there, which is a fixed gear, which I would be ripping mad skids on because that's how you have to stop them. No brakes, baby.
You just stop pedaling.
Well, if you stop pedaling, the force of the pedals and the rear wheel will throw you over the front of the bike and like kill you, right?
So how do you stop? You just whip it sideways. You do a little whip.
You either, if you're very strong, you stop pedaling and you hold it and the rear wheel will stop, which that is a lot of pounds of force. I don't even.
Do you lean forward in this scenario to, you know, relieve some of the.
You would lean your arms forward to put your weight on the front. You put part of your brace on the front wheel and then you put your weight to the back to support your legs because your legs are basically going to take all of the impact of the rear wheel stopping.
My question is, why does this device exist? Like, why doesn't it just have fucking brakes? They're awesome.
Because once upon a time you didn't have free wheel ratchets, right? So bikes in the early 20th century didn't have free wheel ratchets. So they were all if you stop pedaling, the bike would try and kill you, right? So what
I'm confused. Are you saying that you have a bike from the early 20th century in there somewhere? Is that what you're saying?
Behind me, yeah. Well, no, because track bikes, you know, bikes that they race on the track, like Olympics, all that kind of stuff, that's all still done with fixed gear bikes. So a lot of people, bike couriers, people who ride in the city still ride fixed gear bikes because they have no moving parts. They have literally a chain, pedals, and typically there's a optional front brake, but like even then it doesn't really do anything and you don't use it. Like it's the simplest bike you can possibly own. You have like a chain, pedals, a chain ring, and that's it. And it's direct.
So they don't have any gears at all.
Nope.
So what happens like when you're, you know, I feel like you're limiting your top speed a bit there because it's pretty hard to like apply the torque when your legs are going really fast around in circles.
Yeah.
It's like an angular momentum problem.
You haven't thought this through very. So if you on a road bike, right, you can do like 38 kilometers an hour if you're feeling good, like just on your way into work, right? But you've got brakes, right? So you can slow down and stop in maybe 40, 50 meters, something like that. On a fixed gear, if you are cycling at 40 kilometers an hour, your stopping distance is way longer.
I'm thinking about racing around in a circle.
Oh, right. Yeah, you just put a massive chain ring on there.
So that's obviously why then all these people have got Christmas ham thighs to get that thing moving.
Yeah, exactly. And remember, so because the other benefit of it on a track bike is it's more mechanically efficient because it's just, there's no gears. It's just one. And that saves like, you know, what, 5% or 2% or whatever. And that's the difference between winning or losing when you're talking about hundredths of a second these races are won by. So
is there a lot of like per rider tweaking to like find the sweet spot between, you know, what that rider can apply in terms of torque with the angular momentum of their sort of feet, sort of what suits them the best, you know, because you got drag, you got your bike drag, and you really need to like have the power zone for that person where, you know, this is like the peak.
So your
revolutions per minute for the amount of torque that they can apply with their quads, like, because, you know, as the faster you go, the harder it is to get the torque down before the pedal's out.
The answer to that question is yes, people spend literally millions and millions of dollars on that. Like for national teams, like the Australian track team are pretty successful. I would guess that their annual budget on R&D and that kind of stuff is probably like $10 million or something like that. Like they must spend, these guys will have all of the track teams that win have like access to wind tunnels and shit. Like if you want to win the Tour de France, your team has to have access to a wind tunnel, right? You will use every single like 5% extra efficiency, 1% extra efficiency. Like, the height of socks is regulated in professional bike racing, because it turns out they, in a wind tunnel, they've tested this, is that if you just have a sock that comes all the way up your leg, it's more efficient than skin, right? And so the UCI says, well, no, you can't just wear massive socks. You have to have, like, there's a maximum sock height, because otherwise that's cheating. That's just wearing, like, aerodynamic extra stuff.
So right? It all is heavily regulated. So you couldn't, for example, have a different kind of mechanism for your pedal gear. Like, you couldn't have, like, a, you know, an expanding gear or something that works on angular momentum. You couldn't do that.
Well, so think about just the shape of the bike, right? The shape of the bike is like three triangles, isn't it? It's like the frame, and then it's the rear dropouts, and then two wheels. That is regulated, right? You have to have a bike that has that shape if you want to ride in the UCI.
But so what about the drive mechanism, like the pedals?
I'm pretty certain there are a whole bunch of rules about how that has to work. It has to be, you can obviously have like you can have electronic shifting and whatever the fuck you want. That's up to you. The reason that they use direct drive on the track is because it's more efficient. That's the reason, right? And you're in a velodrome. So there's no hill. There's just a straight track, and you're essentially riding on the flat with no wind. So
are you allowed a belt drive?
You probably can have a belt drive, but they are not widely manufactured or in use. So,
I mean, if your budget's $10 million a year, I think you could fucking make it.
Yeah, but then if it fails once at the Tour de France, your team is going to go, why the fuck did we use that one untested part when we could have just used Shimano?
Well, I mean, people do that shit all the time in Formula One, right? Their teams develop stuff like...
That's probably more likely to happen in the Olympics, I think, because I think the national teams, they're quite often winning or losing by like a hundredth of a second on the velodrome. And so they're much more keen to try like zany ideas. Whereas like if your bike explodes halfway through, like if your bike explodes on like the velodrome in like a 2 or 3 minute sprint, You know, you look like a bit of an ass, right? And you have to explain to the Australian sports papers, oh yeah, we thought that we were going to smash it, but then the bike exploded, and people go, oh, that's a bit of a bummer. If you lose the Tour de France on stage like 17, because 110 kilometers into a 200 kilometer stage, your bike explodes and the team car ain't there, and you lose 2 minutes, like 50 million euros worth of sponsors are going to kill you. They're just going to defund your team. They're going to be like, your entire season is fucked because you decide to YOLO it?
Because you wanted to make something new, you asshole. Yeah.
Whereas I feel like maybe on the national teams and stuff for the Olympics, they have a lot more of a risk-taking attitude. And also like in the past as well, because the Olympics and stuff and the world championships and whatnot, to a lesser extent, because that's a UCI race, but the rules that the UCI put down about what you could and couldn't do were very different to, I think, the Olympic rules. So I think you used to see like a lot more wacky looking machines at the Olympics because the rules were lighter. I feel like a lot of the bikes and things you see on the velodrome, like the Olympics that just happened, were pretty wacky. Because again, it doesn't have to ride on a road. So it doesn't really have to, like, you don't have to worry about like, oh, will the tires hold up for 100 kilometers of racing? Are they going to explode if they see a tiny bit of glass because the road's not been swept or anything, right? It's a public road. Whereas like on the velodrome, it's like, well, there's not going to be any fucking glass. So, you know, whatever. Unless Noel's there and he's throwing fucking, they're probably cans. As tinnies is probably more your style, right?
Throwing experiments at the bikes.
Yeah. Maybe you should be. Maybe you should have been a mechanical aerodynamics performance coach or something like that in a different life.
Well, I feel like my knowledge of engineering.
I thought about this for 5 minutes, and I reckon I could do it better than these guys that have been doing it for 20 years.
Yeah, well, some people are just more mechanically minded than others.
Well, there you go. Anyway, that's a very around the houses. I can't even what. Why the fuck did we get onto bikes? I blew up my bike. Yeah, there we go.
I mean, I was just wondering why you had a 1920s bike in your house, basically. So,
it's not 1920s. It's a sick, sick bike.
Sick. Do you do a little bit of currying on the side? Couriering?
No, I just used to like riding fixed, and then I had a kid, and now I'm too scared to ride fixed because I'm a chicken.
Got it.
Yeah.
So why do you keep it around? Is it just like a, you know, because it's just something you can't get rid of now? You're like, fuck, I need to keep that clutter.
I mean, I could probably sell it for quite a bit of money. It's a really nice build, but I can't. In my heart of hearts, I feel like I will ride it again. We will ride again.
One day we will ride again. You know, the world's paved with good intentions. There's a lot of things I want to like do, but just don't have the time or like the money or the patience. So, like a decade ago, I got a pilot's license, never flew again. You would love to get back into that. Yeah, just don't have the fucking time. Like before all of it, before crypto and all that stuff, back when I was a free man. Fucking, you know, I finished a project and a contract that I was working on, and I had a few pennies in my pocket, and I'm like, fuck, man, I'm having a holiday and getting a pilot's license. Went and did that.
Once you got a pilot's license, what happens?
Went back to work, and then that was that.
Do you just like rent a plane from time to time? Like, how does that work?
Yeah, I'd go like fucking 2 days a week. I'd go and rent the plane, go flying with the instructor, then get my license, then go flying by myself, and then went back to work, and then fucking no more flying.
Where do you look at? Yeah, cool, man. That sounds sick.
Yeah, it is pretty cool. The freedom of flying is like, there's nothing. I mean, it's not really freedom because it fucking costs a lot to rent, right? It's not like you just go down to the Hertz and rent a plane. You got to like go through the rigmarole. You need all the special license and, competencies, and you got to log everything. And it's a real regulated bloody thing. But when you're up there and you can just go wherever the fuck you want, like really fast, it's great. You can't really land anywhere, but, you know, picking up what I'm putting down.
Yeah, fair enough. Well, I mean, if you just like want to fly, then can't you just like go parasending or something? Because that's a lot less hassle potentially.
Parasailing?
You know, when you see those guys with this big, you know, the big
parachute, wing. Like controlled falling.
No, not parachuting. The one where you go up on a hill and then you pull that big wing.
Oh yeah, no, fuck that.
And then you just
I'm not doing that.
Well, why? You just said you fucking it's the same
something
thing
with a motor. You know?
Oh, right. Well, you can put a motor on those as well, right?
Well, that's a different thing. That's a paraglider.
Yeah, maybe that's a paraglider. I mean, I'm not boned up on the difference. I don't fly.
One's a sail, other one's a glider.
Yeah, all right. But that, if you do it in the, you know, you make one of those big nylon sail things, like it's functionally the same, whether you have a motor on it or not. Like you're just strapping a motor to your back, aren't you, at the end of the day?
Instead of like, yeah, a machine, I guess.
Yeah, I'm just saying. Yeah, the barrier to entry, probably.
Put it this way: that ain't for me.
Yeah,
I prefer something, you know, with a windscreen you can sit in, nice comfy seat, get your music going, your aviators on, like you're fucking cool.
I can see that the pattern is comfy seat, no physical exertion. That's
yeah, but I just want to go like this. Like, I don't want to be like, oh, fucking trees.
Why don't you just like Microsoft Flight Simulator? You've got a spare desk behind you. You could get like a joystick and some rudder pedals and shit and pretend you're flying like a 737 or something.
I mean, if I was going to spend time flying, I'd just fucking go flying. But I just don't have the time.
Just too much time in the shitcoin mines.
Well, yeah, I guess when it comes down to it, that's probably the problem.
Yeah. What you need is for the market to go Muno, and then you could finally retire to, well, not beach, probably literally the same chair you're sitting in now, and just go fly your plane.